So, it is my great pleasure to welcome the author of Conversations with Richard Purcell, The Adventures and Reflections of a San Francisco Renegade Priest, Susan Caslin. Susan spoke on Mystical Positivist recently. We had a wonderful conversation. Stuart and I had a wonderful conversation with her. And we are very much looking forward to her discussion of this book, how it came to be written, and what Richard Purcell meant to her and to others, and we are so grateful she could join us tonight. Thank you so much.
Right, thank you.
All right.
So, did either of you hear the interview at all?
I did not.
You didn't? Okay, that's good. Because they did a great job interviewing me and really, you know, dug out a lot of information that I'm probably going to share today. So, too, I'm not going to talk a long time. I'm just going to give you an overview of who Richard Purcell was and then just read a few things from the book. And then if you have any questions or if you want to share what brought you here, maybe we could do that as well. So Richard Purcell was an openly gay Franciscan priest who ran a homeless shelter for men with AIDS in the Intermission District in San Francisco for 20 years. And he called
Where was it in the Intermission?
Let's see.
Just rough.
Lower 24th Street and Treat Street. It was on Treat Street.
I don't know Treat, but
Kind of near like Alabama, Folsom and Harrison.
Got it.
Yeah.
Okay.
He ran it. He called it Marty's Place, and it was named after his brother Marty Purcell, who died of AIDS in 1989. And Richard came to San Francisco to take care of him. And then he opened the shelter after Marty died. Prior to that, Richard had lived for a while with Dorothy Day in New York City. And Dorothy Day, if you don't know, was a socialist anarchist who at the beginning of the 20th century, when she was a young woman, converted to Catholicism. And she wanted to start a movement that was based on her political beliefs, but also the social teachings of the Catholic Church. It wasn't part of the Catholic Church. In fact, they didn't want to have anything to do with her, but it still goes on today. And it consists mostly of soup kitchens, homeless shelters, and communal farms, which are all over the country and perhaps, I believe, the world. But it's not an organized movement. It's very anarchistic. Anyone who wants to start one of these things does so. And that's what Richard did. So he modeled it after the Catholic worker model, in that he didn't take any government funding, so he wouldn't have to deal with government regulations. And everybody who worked for the homeless shelter just did so voluntarily, including himself. So, and he did most of the work, and he lived there with the men. And in an earlier part of his life, he had lived for 20 years with Native Americans in southern Arizona. And that's what he based a lot of his spirituality on. He was very moved by the American Indians and really sort of shifted his spirituality after he lived with them, even though he remained a priest until he died. Actually, at the time that he died, he pretty much considered himself an agnostic, although he was one of the most spiritual people many of us had ever met. So I met him in 2005, and in 2006 he was diagnosed with ALS, or Lou Gehrig's disease. And I'm sure you know it's a very horrendous illness of the neurological system where a person gradually becomes paralyzed until they're completely paralyzed and they can't breathe. And then they either suffocate or they get hooked up to a ventilator. And Richard had decided he didn't want to be hooked up to a ventilator. He wanted to just die naturally. And he hoped to die at Marty's Place. And he spent most of his illness there. And there was a lot of his friends, including myself, and some of the men who had AIDS that he helped care for, began to care for him. And we called ourselves the Circle of Care. And we cared for him in Marty's Place, which was this beautiful old Victorian. And the house became like a center, a community center, where people were always coming and going and interacting with each other. And the focus of it was Richard's dying. And it may sound like it was a depressing experience to watch someone die of this disease, but in fact, it was actually quite joyful for the most part. At times it was difficult, but for the most part, it was very joyful. And we were all kind of changed by this experience. Many people considered Richard a spiritual teacher. In fact, I talked to some of his Franciscan brothers who they felt he was a mystic, although I don't know if I would go that far knowing him personally, because he had some personal faults. He was very human as well. But I definitely felt he was a spiritual teacher. He was a very engaging man. He was extremely funny. He had a great sense of humor. The Native Americans that he lived with considered him a spiritual teacher, and they continued to make the pilgrimage from Arizona to San Francisco to visit him, so we got to know them as well. And
that was after, 20 years?
Yeah, he had left the last reservation in 1988, so it was a long time ago, but they were still coming. And some of the people had not even been born when he lived there, but his reputation within these tribes lived on. So as a writer, I just was so moved by what was going on, I wanted to write down what was happening, and so I started to write this book. And I wrote it as Richard was dying, and I read most of the book to him. And he helped me with the book in that he really wanted to make sure that when I quoted him, I did so correctly. And someone had given him a tape recorder, so he kept a journal. And I transcribed the journal. So that's a segment of this book as well that he wrote directly. So I'll just read a few segments from it. One thing that, of course, he talked a lot about was death, because he was dealing with, he was in the act of dying. And this segment is called Death. Despite what he said about St. Francis, I felt that there was still much about the saint that was very appealing to Richard. Richard had, after all, spent his life living and working with the poor, although he told me that his vow of poverty didn't mean living in destitution. It means not clinging, he said, non-attachment, not holding on. This philosophy didn't just apply to material things. It could apply to anything, people, places, grudges, disappointments, and eventually even life itself. Richard had decided that his death was not going to be a mournful event. He joked about it and celebrated it. He had ordered a cardboard box from a crematorium, the kind they used to haul bodies away in. This box would become his coffin. When his hands were still working, he had painted it with colorful stripes and had written little phrases on it, such as, "I told you I was sick," "All's well that ends well," and "I love happy endings." Across the top of the box were the footprints of a coyote, an animal that represents folly or trickster in Native American symbolism. "Death is good," he would tell me. Of course, I'm not talking about some terrible tragic deaths, especially with the very young, but in the end, we're all dying, you know. When are you going to start working on your cardboard box? Richard said that if you check out the obituaries, you will read things like, "So-and-so finally passed away after a valiant struggle against cancer or some other disease." Nobody writes, "So-and-so died after befriending leukemia, which encouraged her to do something different with her life." "Me," said Richard, "I've decided to look on ALS as my friend." "Your friend?" I asked. "Yes, it is my friend because it's encouraging me to go further. It's helping me experience people, places, and things that I wouldn't have encountered if I didn't have ALS. A friend that kills you? That's one way of looking at it, but maybe the killing leads to something different. Life is full of change, and wouldn't it be boring if it wasn't?" Richard liked to paraphrase a quote from John Henry Newman, who said that life is change, and to change often is to live well. "Change is the one thing we can count on," Richard explained. "So why not look on all these surprises in life as a blessing? We don't know where they'll lead us, but if we live in fear about every change that comes our way, we're really going to suffer." There were several men at Marty's place
I just ask a question?
Sure.
In that quote, when I read it originally, just hearing it again, just now made me think of this interesting idea of poverty. It starts off with the discussion of poverty and the poverty about grudges, even such stuff like that. I thought that was a really interesting notion of applying the rule of poverty to things that we imagine that we don't want, but actually people hold on to, you know, very pointedly sometimes.
Yeah, exactly. And as we talked about on the radio, you know, I don't know if you know much about Franciscan spirituality, but St. Francis looked on poverty as a lover. He called it sister poverty. But Richard, you know, he was a Franciscan, but he didn't really see it that way. He didn't believe that poverty meant living in destitution, and he certainly didn't think that poverty was a beautiful thing. It could be very ugly, but that's what he said. It was not clinging to things. You know, you could enjoy things, but you don't hold tight to them.
Thank you.
So some of the men at Marty's place had chemical dependency issues they were struggling with, and some were in recovery. And I asked Richard about this because I thought that must have been really difficult for him running the house when a lot of these guys, the reason they were homeless in, combined with the AIDS, were often drug and alcohol problems. And at first when he, at first he just would kick them out if they were drinking or using. He said it was all or nothing. But then he took more of a harm reduction approach to it. Like he said, as long as they weren't disrupting the household and they were doing something like going to AA, or getting counseling, then he would let them stay and he would work with them. But I asked him more about this, and he admitted that at times it was harder to deal with addicts, especially since his personality was rather easygoing and he had trouble setting boundaries with people. But I've always had this philosophy of opening my home to strangers, he said. I figured that if somebody turned up at my doorstep, it was for a reason. I also feel that everybody is damaged on some level, even if it's just living in fear. Everybody is addicted. We're all addicted to this horrible culture, the crappy, lying educational system, the healthcare system, which is based on profit and giving out too many drugs, a legal system, so much of which is built around the prison industry, the military-industrial complex, which we believe is saving our asses, and addicted to religion, which has no connection to the divine. If somebody showed up at my door, I often found that he was an angel in disguise who had come to bless me. Some of these men were wrapped in barbed wire or broken glass, but coming from this culture, how could they not be damaged? And then they got planted in this house, just like an injured bird or a withered plant that needed water and sunlight. They found a lovely place to flourish, and they were given a lot of love and support. I watched these men blossom into beautiful flowers. That is an extremely gratifying experience. Sure, I had to throw out a few, but the rest became healthier members of society until they died in peace. And as you can see, some are still around and caring for me.
So do you know how people found out about Marty's place?
How did they find it?
In order to find their way to that door?
I think it was sometimes just by rumor. There was a waiting list. There was an official foundation that started Marty's place. Richard started the foundation. And he just did it on a wing and a prayer. He just somehow pulled it all together. And they set up kind of a formal way of setting up a waiting list for people to get in. But oftentimes, if someone just showed up at the door and there was a bed, he would just let them in and they'd go to the top of the list. And he had dealt with like that in other areas of his life, too. Marty's place wasn't the first time he had taken people into his home. When he was living in Arizona, he was part of the sanctuary movement. And he housed people that were fleeing the wars in Central America. So things like that. He just did that. He always lived collectively with people and welcomed people into his home.
Well, I guess as a Franciscan, he would have lived collectively earlier on.
He did, and he resisted living with the Franciscans later. He tried not to. He was just too much of a free spirit to live in kind of a structured environment, like, you know, with a group of priests. In fact, he could have gotten free room and board if he had, at that point in his life, if he lived with the other priests, wherever they lived. But he just didn't feel like that was his thing. He said, the way he put it is, I don't want to live with a bunch of old men. He wanted to live with the poor, like he had always done, out in the community. And he said, basically, that's what St. Francis had wanted to do. And that's what he started, like, over 800 years ago when he started the movement. But the Pope and the Rome got hold of it, and they wanted more structure to the whole thing. And they changed it. So, let's see here. So, as I said, he was a gay man, and he had no qualms about being open about that. And that way, I think he was a very integrated person. He didn't lie about who he was. He said when he was a younger man, he tried to cover some of that up, and he came off as being a little uptight and guarded because he didn't want people to know his secret. And then he realized he didn't want to live like that. He wanted to get to know people and have them get to know him. So he was telling me that one day, and then he continued saying, a lot of men believe that if you like to paint, garden, play the piano, or if you care for others, you're weak, as if women or the feminine are inferior. We have this superstition that women are bad, and then we beat up on women and destroy the feminine. We certainly see this in religious structures, and most of the people making judgments about women and gays in the church are bloody queens. I saw this photo of the Pope the other day in a newspaper. Well, his nibs was wearing patent leather red Pradas. On top of his white dress, he had on what looked like an embroidered tablecloth and a silk shawl that had ermine along the border. I swear, he must have been going through the Vatican closet from the 16th century. And he's calling us names? Get a grip, sweetheart. That's why we have to fight, and we don't have to do it maliciously. It just comes to a point, though, when you have to commit yourself. You have to speak up. I can't even go to Mass anymore, because when I leave, I feel worse than when I went in. I was celebrating Mass until I got ALS, and this disease came just in time. Because I was believing one thing and doing another. I don't believe in playing games with the sacred. One time I was celebrating Mass in a church in San Francisco. From the pulpit, I mentioned that it would be nice if some of us, as members of this church, marched in the gay pride parade. Well, this woman stood up in the front row and went ballistic. She stood up and shouted, "That's enough. Shut up." So I shut up. I wasn't about to argue with her right there in the sanctuary. She got out of her pew and started pacing in the back of the church. The next day, I got a call from the pastor. He said, "Hey, Richard, I hear you had a little showdown at Mass last night." I said, "Yeah, a little. I'm used to it." He said, "Well, I want to see you in my office today at 2 o'clock. I said, "Sorry, I'm busy." He said, "Then I'll see you at 10 o'clock on Monday." I said, "I'm busy on Monday, too." I wasn't going to let him get the upper hand. I said, "No, if you want to see me, you come to my office." And I didn't have an office. He said, "Well, we can't have you saying Mass here if you're talking like that." I told him that was fine with me. Well, he was a good friend of that woman who chewed my ass off. And he was gay himself. He even had a boyfriend. The thing is, if church... The thing is, if church doesn't work for you, then start your own church. I mean, what is church, anyway? It's people gathered together in community. It's a support system that helps keep you balanced. I grew up in an Irish Catholic family, so we had many superstitions. One was that repetitive prayer, such as the rosary or saying novenas, would help us, as if God was up there watching us, counting our prayers and taking notes. Thank God I grew to another plateau in my spirit life. I don't believe in superstitions anymore, but I do believe in having a caring heart.
That's a particularly nice quote.
So, as I said, he considered himself an agnostic, and I was reading him, I read to him a lot, you know, while he was ill, and I was reading him Spiritual Envy, Agnostic's Quest by Michael Krasny. I don't know if you've heard that book. And I asked him, are you an agnostic? And he said, "Perhaps. I don't use the word atheist because it's too severe." Using Krasny's own words, I asked, "How do you explain spiritual hunger or the need for every culture throughout history to seek or to try to define God?" "I think it's what we've discussed before," he replied. "We all yearn for beauty." "So do you believe that the myths and rituals that cultures design around a higher power are meaningless?" "No, not at all. We need myths and rituals. They help us try and make sense of why we're here." "But if you don't believe in God, then what's the point of any of it? Why be charitable or selfless?" "It's like I said before," said Richard. "I guess I believe that God is love, but we ourselves have to form and fashion love. God doesn't come from a spirit on high. God is inside each of us. So getting back to myths and rituals, if our rituals are beautiful, they help us form beautiful acts. And it's through beautiful acts that love emerges. That was one good thing about the old Catholicism, the beautiful rituals. Protestants don't have that, and Catholics have less of it since the Ecumenical Council. Now mostly all you have is a bunch of words. You quote Jesus a lot," I mentioned. "That's because he says some great things. I love to quote people. I'd quote Peter Pan if he said something significant." I wiped Richard's eyes with a Kleenex. Those of us who cared for him instinctively watched for the fuzz and moisture that often accumulated around his eyes. Without being asked, we would perform the simple tasks that he could no longer do for himself. "I guess," Richard went on, "what I truly believe in is transparency in thought, in speech, and in spirit life, so that light can come through, to get rid of what is opaque. This isn't about finding the right answers. In fact, the more answers you have, the more trouble you're often in. You don't need a lot of answers or spiritual teachings except to live by the golden rule, to do unto others as you would have them do unto you. That's all you need." So I thought I'd read just one more thing here. This was from his journal. And one thing we often talked about was the priest sex scandals and, you know, the sexual abuse that priests were involved in, and also celibacy of priests. And he addressed this in this one journal entry, which he wrote on December 10th, 2009. What a sad thing if somebody goes through their life and never allows himself to fall in love. Falling in love is part of me and has taught me life. It opened me to life. It taught and teaches me so many things. I don't know how priests can talk to people about love, especially married love, committed love, without having experienced it. This chastity thing is a real horror. This business of keeping our knees together and guarding some dried up soul, which is like a prune, never having loved, never having suffered, it just doesn't make sense. Sometimes people were put upon by priests who weren't lovers. People were used in a sexual way that was terrible. Very strange things happen to us if we don't open ourselves to love, to become flowers. We become tight buds, or maybe we just remain leaves on the vine with no flower or scent or beauty for the world.
It's maybe the phrase renegade priest is an understatement.
I'm surprised that he was allowed to stay in the Catholic Church and they didn't kick him out, or
yeah,
that he would want to stay.
Well, he kind of kept a really low profile. I think he was probably in danger of being kicked out. But for one thing, he was actually kicked out of a job once on an Indian reservation where he worked. He butted heads with the bishop and got kicked off that job. But the only time he was a parish priest was on the reservations, and I think they were out in the middle of nowhere, so he could kind of, you know, hide out from the hierarchy there. And then when he started Marty's Place, he solicited the funding himself. So he just did that separate from the church. And he was very fond of his Franciscan brothers. They were very close. In fact, he told me most of them were gay. And he actually believed that there are, not most, but a lot of religious leaders, not just Catholics, are gay. You know, and I just think, you know, gay people may be drawn to that, to being a religious teacher or leader for a variety of reasons. But he really loved his brothers, and they were actually pretty progressive. It was a progressive group of men, perhaps because they were based in California. So, and they liked him a lot and let him get away with a lot. But so a lot of what he told me, he would say, no, you can't say that. I mean, it would come out of his mouth. And like when he was describing I asked him at one point, I said, do you think a lot of priests are gay? And he said, does the Pope live in Rome? That was his response. And then he said, does the bitch wear pink shoes? And then he went, don't write that down, you know.
Well, the story about his altercation with the bishop in Arizona is interesting, so maybe you might just recount that one as an illustration where it wasn't only just about sexuality, where
yeah,
he was a renegade.
He actually didn't, he knew he was gay while he was living on the reservations, but he didn't come out as a gay person to the Native Americans, just because it never came up, you know. It just wasn't something that was talked about, but he said he wouldn't have denied it if they had asked it.
This is really in the middle of a tremendous huge desert.
It's very remote.
What tribe?
They used to be the Papago and the Pima, but they changed their name to the Tohono O'odham and the Kila O'odham.
Okay, well, I used to live in Arizona. So
oh, you did?
I
oh,
know,
you know them. Okay.
I know where you're. I was just trying to locate it.
Oh, okay, great. Yeah.
West of Tucson, basically.
Right.
Yeah. So there were a lot of parishes on these reservations, and he was the pastor for, I believe, 14 of them. He oversaw that, so he'd drive to the different churches, and the people began to really love him, and he learned their language, and he grew to love them, and they all wanted to come to his church. And, you know, a lot of the other religious leaders on the other churches got very jealous and didn't like that. And he got into a run-in with one particular nun who had a lot of personal problems, the way it was told to me. I asked a lot of people who lived there at that time, trying to figure out what had happened. And this particular nun, she sort of fashioned herself a guru among the Native Americans. I think she was part Native American herself, and she also had a serious drinking problem. And so she was troubled. And he said she even made a pass at him once. But she was quite troubled, and but he could see right through her, and then she felt really threatened by that. And this one brother had told me this, and so she started stirring a pot of trouble. And once you start stirring trouble, there's no stopping it. But Richard also kind of got himself in trouble because he was changing the mass. I don't know if any of you, I know you were, Rob, you said you're Catholic, yeah. You were raised Catholic, but are you folks have any experience with the Catholic Church?
Well, I wasn't raised Catholic, yeah. But I understand what you're...
Yeah, it was, I mean, it's a very, very serious thing. You have to say the mass as it's written. And so Richard was screwing around with it, because he was trying to do something more creative that the people could really get into. And so that got him in trouble, too, with the bishop.
Wasn't it also, I thought I remember reading that, it's like, it was creative, but also it was creative in a sense of empowering the Native American people by incorporating elements of their culture into the mass.
Definitely, yeah, bringing some of that out into the mass. And
yeah. And actually, if you look at, there's been over the centuries an awful lot of creativity along those lines among Catholic priests throughout Latin America, for sure, and I have no doubt in Africa as well, in doing just exactly that sort of thing.
Uh-huh.
And in fact, I think even further back, 1,500 years ago, the church was doing that sort of thing in Europe and other arenas as well. What's renegated at one moment is not necessarily may eventually find a place in cultural context. But anyway, finish the story.
Yeah, for sure. Yeah, no. So anyway, so the bishop did kick him off the reservation. And the Native Americans were very upset, and they tried to meet with the troublemakers to say, we don't want this, and they weren't listened to, no one paid attention to them. And he was quite devastated, but he did tell me that, you know, if he hadn't gotten kicked out, then other new things wouldn't have happened in his life. So sometimes when something bad happens, you know, it opens a door for something else to happen. So, yeah.
You're talking about the mass and putting in changes. I have a friend who was an ex Catholic priest, and he did this tinkering thing, you know, with the mass. And I think this is like decades ago, but I think it was probably the 80s. Anyway, he was I think it was either Portland or Seattle, and he would change things or add elements or, you know, like, and one day at the end of the mass, an elderly parishioner came up to him and said, "Do your masses count?"
Uh-oh. Oh, that's classic. That's a good story.
And he said, "I don't know." And of course, he's supposed to know.
God only gave him a half star or something.
Oh,
like that.
Oh man.
His journey out. The priesthood.
Yeah, no, I mean, and I can really relate to that story because, you know, my parents just follow the mass. I mean, they follow what the church teaches right down the hill. And it's sad. It's so sad to live their whole lives thinking that they have to do this, you know. It's just.
How did you get involved with him?
Well, I moved to the Intermission District in 2002. And I met a lovely Mexican-American woman who befriended me. And she had a lesbian daughter, and she told me about a church that she was involved in, Most Holy Redeemer, which is in the Castro. She was straight, but she really liked the gay community that she had found through her daughter and started going to this church.
Good for her.
Yeah, she was wonderful. And so I went with her, and she was also a member of the Secular Franciscan Order of that parish. I don't know if you folks know what that is. It's a third order, yeah. And she invited me to their meeting, and I was just really touched by these people. They were wonderful people. It was led by Father Louis Vital. I don't know if anyone's heard of him. He's quite well known in San Francisco. And so I decided I wanted to be part of that organization, so I joined it, and that's how I met Richard. And Father Louis was always going to prison because he was always protesting military activities. and he got thrown in prison again, so we didn't have a leader, and so Richard was chosen, so he became our leader for a while until he got too sick to get up and down the stairs. So yeah, so I started hanging out at Marty's place, and everybody that knew Richard really fell in love with him, and I really enjoyed what was going on at Marty's place. So that's how the relationship began.
So you helped out at Marty's place and also helped him.
Yeah. Uh-huh. So.
So when he was going through his process, one thing that wasn't exactly clear to me is there were still, you know, AIDS patients there essentially, and it was not clear because you said some people were able to help him, and yet they were still going through their dying process. I mean, what?
Well, they actually weren't. None of the guys that I met who had AIDS were dying, and I mean, okay. That was the beauty of the new drugs. In fact, that's what he said, that initially when he started it, the shelter, everybody would die, and they died actually quite quickly. But then the drugs came, and then they were surviving, and that's when the chemical dependency problems really became a problem, because before that, addicts and alcoholics would just die. But all the guys that I had met there are still fine. You know, they're around, walking around and everything, and so because of these drugs. So, but when Richard was diagnosed, the foundation realized that it was not a good idea for, he could no longer run the place. So Richard helped them find other places to live. So they were no longer living in the house after, you know, maybe about a year or so after he was diagnosed. But a lot of them still came back to the house because there was always food there. The foundation kept the refrigerator full, and there was always cooking going on. And there was laundry facilities so that they could do their laundry there. And some of them were most of them were actually Latino immigrants that I met. And I guess because it was in the mission, they ended up there. So they were, they were very poor. A lot of them were living on GA, which is almost nothing. And some of them were refugees that had fled, you know, really homophobic situations in other countries. One guy was beat up and almost killed by the police. And a couple of the guys Richard had helped find asylum for, based on their sexual orientation. So.
Thank you.
Yeah, well, thanks for listening.
So when did he die? Yeah.
He died in 2011, August of 2011.
August, so quite recently.
Yeah, right. And I wanted to get the book out quickly after he died, just so while his memory was still, you know, fresh.
So basically, it sounds like you must have been done with the book, essentially.
I was just waiting for him to die, basically, because I knew that was going to be the ending.
Right.
And he didn't want it published until after he died. And it could be because he didn't want to get in trouble for some of the things he said. I don't know. But that's what
he never specified why he...
No, he didn't. I never really asked him. But I kind of figured that might have been it. He felt like that way he could have been really honest.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So for the future for you, what do you take away from your time with him, with assisting in Marty's. I don't know what's happening with you.
Yeah.
As you move forward from this, since it's less than a year now.
Yeah.
Much less than a year.
Yeah. I mean, I think what I took from him was I was a lot more present in my life, just being present for the moment, you know, and much more optimistic, because he was always very optimistic and joyful, you know. And looking forward to life, and this thing about change that, you know, there's surprises coming up around the bend, and I'm more excited about life than I was before. I'm more accepting of death, my own possible death, whenever that happens, and also I had lost my brother to AIDS in 2003, so that helped me kind of deal with that. I was more accepting of that. Just because I saw that it was a natural process, and it's not so much how long we live, but maybe what we do while we're here. I'm a teacher. I teach nursing, and I found that I was able to approach my students with a much more fresh kind of way of seeing them. I was seeing them in a new way. Before I met Richard, I was finding myself being kind of pessimistic about my job sometimes. Like they were irritating me because they weren't doing the things I wanted them to do. But I started to just see them like as individuals, and that they had something to teach me. And I don't know if that makes sense, but all of a sudden I started really enjoying my job, and they liked me a lot more. I was getting better student evaluations, so I mean, that's one way it manifested in my life. I just seem to be enjoying life a lot more. So
that's a great gift. A great gift.
How about as a writer? What, where would you take your?
Well, I feel really, really fortunate that I had this opportunity. Richard helped me get them funding for this, and so I've never written a book before. So, I mean, I've written a couple books, but they haven't been published. But to have the opportunity to do this and then to get feedback on it, it's been wonderful. And it, I mean, the feedback's been positive, so that's been good. Yeah, it makes me want to continue.
What kind of subject matter do you look?
Well, I've written mostly nonfiction and poetry, and I've written for some newspapers, mm-hmm. so I've done some of that. I did attempt to write a novel, and I have finished a novel, and I think that would be the next thing. If I do get published again, that's what I would publish. And it's not my forte to write fiction. I don't even read fiction, but it was sort of kind of a coming of age novel. That I think a lot of writers, they need to tell that story. So it's based on truth, and I just need to fine tune it. And then now I actually self-published this, but you have to have a chunk of money in order to self-publish. So I learned a lot about self-publishing. I tried to get a publisher, but you know that's almost impossible. So I learned a lot about publishing, and I learned that I could do it for a lot less money than I ended up paying for this. So maybe if I could just get some more money together, then I'd get my novel published as well.
Okay.
Yeah. So
thank you.
Well, thank you for this opportunity, and thank you guys for listening.
Thank you.
Yeah. It's very, very interesting. And obviously an interesting guy and an interesting time for you in
yeah.
your life.
Yeah, for sure.
Right. Well, thank you on behalf of many rivers. Okay. Very much appreciated.
So, I guess I'll take some of those books back, huh? It doesn't